This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review program. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. And with me in the studio here in the UK, we have Mihailo Zekic.
Hello.
And in our studio in Edmund, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And Sam Livingston.
Thanks for having me.
And in our studio in Jerusalem, we have Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
Well, Russia and its president, Vladimir Putin, have really been driving the news agenda this week. Here to tell us about some of his latest statements, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, Russian President Vladimir Putin gave his annual press conference yesterday. This is something he does every year, and it's kind of a big deal in Russia. It really kind of bolsters his domestic image. He routinely goes, I think he almost always goes, over 3 hours when he gives these things. This year he had even more to say. He actually talked for 4 hours, so I'll do our best in this program to summarize what he said in less time than that. But he made several pretty powerful statements in that 4 hour rant. One of them, he actually really praised China, saying that the Russia-China partnership has no precedent in history. So he's saying that this is this close alliance that you can't even compare anything to. But he also, after really putting some big praise on China, spent most of his time criticizing America and the West. Now, if you've been following this program and our website, you'll know that Russia has had a huge buildup of troops along the Ukrainian border, probably between 100,000 and some say even as high as 175,000 troops, which have led many analysts to speculate whether Putin's getting ready to invade Ukraine. Now, actually, as you pointed out, Richard, in your Trumpet brief from earlier this week, paraphrasing a bit, there's like people don't normally give four-hour rants threatening to invade a nation before they do it. It's normally it's better to strike first if you actually want land. And so the fact that he's giving this big build up along Ukraine and then giving this 4 hour press conference talking about how America's against Russia shows that he really wants something more than land in Ukraine. He wants concessions from the West, and has made a very long list of concessions that mostly focus on trying to get America to promise to not expand NATO further east. Also had some stuff in there about not allowing America or Russia to station missiles overseas. So some pretty big things that would threaten to basically neuter NATO if America were to comply with these. And even on a threat thing, even if they don't, actually, at Geopolitical Features, George Friedman had a pretty good article talking about just kind of like the attempt to drive a wedge between the American and European parts of NATO, saying that even if Germany, definitely because of their economic interest in Russia, is far less willing to antagonize it. So even if America did try to take a hardline stance against Russia, that really could end up driving a big wedge in NATO anyway. And so Putin kind of, if he plays his cards right, could probably get what he wants coming and going. If he gets America to give him the promise that it won't expand further east, then he opens up this huge sphere in Eastern Europe that he can dominate. And if he gets America to take a hardline approach against him, he could swiftly see a lot of America's European so-called allies, Germany in particular, really breaking ranks with the rest of NATO, not wanting to go along with this.
So you talked about a sphere of influence that Vladimir Putin wants to carve out in Eastern Europe. Is that really what his end goal is? with all of this?
Yeah, well, one of the resources we can put in the show notes today is the book by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, which talks about this this prince, this role that Vladimir Putin plays in the end time, leading like a great revival of the Soviet Empire, and predicting that he'd definitely move into a lot of these former Soviet states, of which like Ukraine and Belarus are amongst them, just from a purely geopolitical standpoint. Like I said, Ukraine produces like some of the vast majorities of like some of the grain that grew in the old Soviet Union, has a ton of other natural resources and infrastructure that Putin definitely feels that he needs to be a world power. And so I definitely think that seems to be what he's looking for with this troop buildup, is to, like I said, get NATO to pull back off of these areas so that he can dominate Ukraine, Belarus, the Baltics. He has ambition. I'm sure he probably has ambitions on Poland as well. I don't think he'll get quite that far. I think that the other Bible prophecies, like the one in Revelation 17 about 10 kings, don't specifically mention Poland, but you think that their ties to Germany are stronger than Ukraine's are. But it's definitely a fight between two emerging power blocks over territory that will have to end in some sort of deal between Russia and Germany, ultimately, not Russia and the United States, before this is all over, because Germany's the one that controls the pipelines and the other things in Western Europe.
And where does the United States then fit into that picture?
Yeah, well, all the prophecies are very clear that the United States, it ultimately is invaded by a European superpower. And so I from another older article that we could probably put in the show notes is Russia Frightens Europe and Fulfills Bible Prophecy. That's one our editor-in-chief wrote back when Putin was pretty new in office, talking about just how these belligerent actions by Russia are pushing together a new European superstate, which is actually the power prophesied to conquer the United States, not Russia. So it's definitely bad news for the United States, not only just the fact that they're losing international prestige to Russia in this fight, but that Russia's belligerent actions in this area are kind of creating the power that is prophesied to clash with the U.S. in the future.
Thank you for that, Andrew. So we could soon have a USSR comeback, but that's not the only comeback some fear. Could Donald Trump be back soon? Left and right are gearing up for a fight over mail-in ballots. Here to tell us about this story is Sam Livingston.
In 2020, mail-in voting was expanded throughout America as never before. And now states are rushing to regulate the fraud-prone practice in opposite ways. According to the left-leaning Voting Rights Lab, some 37 states have passed bills pertaining to mail-in voting. 14 of these states passed bills making mail-in voting more secure, such as allowing mail-in ballots only to those who request them, while 18 states passed bills making mail-in voting less secure, in many cases simply sending out ballots to every registered voter. Last year during the election, or before the election, more than 1.1 million mail-in ballots were considered undeliverable. Another 15 million ballots were not returned at all. So mail-in voting on this scale it's a massive open door for fraud, and that's why most developed countries have banned the practice. And now that the Biden administration has failed in pushing through its Build Back Better plan, it's shifting focus to Nancy Pelosi's For the People Act. Pelosi's been pushing to get this legislation through for years, and what this bill would do is essentially federalize the U.S. voting system and make every state like California. It would require states to create internet-only voting registration, so people never need to leave home. It would allow 16-year-olds and convicted felons to vote. It mandates early voting, same-day registration, widespread mail-in ballots, and permits ballot harvesting. Now, this is the Democrats' attempt to make voter fraud legal. And now this is where they're really shifting focus and pushing this For the People Act. All of this obviously is in preparation for the 2022 and 2024 election cycles. Since the illegal last-minute rule changes worked so well in 2020, Democrats are eager to ensure states like Georgia, Arizona, Florida, and possibly even Wisconsin and Pennsylvania can't outlaw those practices. In reality, they fear a Donald Trump comeback, and they have to fight to preserve the fraud many states are trying to root out. This is why there's such a massive effort right now by the media to get ahead of the news cycle and start shaping the narrative to make it look like Donald Trump and the Republicans are planning to steal the upcoming elections. Recently, The Atlantic published an article titled, "Trump's Next Coup Has Already Begun." Barton Gellman writes, "Trump and his party have convinced a dauntingly large number of Americans that the essential workings of democracy are corrupt, that made-up claims of fraud are true, that only cheating can thwart their victory at the polls, that tyranny has usurped their government, and that violence is a legitimate response." That idea is shared by former U.S. generals. In the Washington Post op-ed, three retired U.S. Army generals wrote, "As we approach the first anniversary of the deadly insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, we are increasingly concerned about the aftermath of the 2024 presidential election and the potential for lethal chaos inside our military, which would put all Americans at severe risk." So these writers and several other members of the press are preparing for the next election battle. They know that the tide is shifting in Donald Trump's favor. A recent Rasmussen poll found that 70% of likely U.S. voters believe it was a bad thing for American democracy for Mark Zuckerberg to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to influence the outcome of the 2020 presidential election. And a lot more fraud in that election is being uncovered. Zuckerberg's money is hundreds of millions of dollars that he donated, helped fund the mailing of ballots. In some districts, he even influenced the design of ballots. So people are waking up to this fraud. It's being exposed in many hearings, and the tide is shifting in Donald Trump's favor. Many states realize that fraud occurred, and they're taking action to prevent it from happening again. Other states know that fraud occurred, and they're taking action to ensure that it happens again. For many years, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has identified Donald Trump as the end-time Jeroboam II. You can read about these prophecies in Amos 7 and 2 Kings 14. These verses indicate that Donald Trump was used by God to temporarily save America, and that he'll also be the leader of America before its fall, meaning that he will somehow return to power. To learn more about this subject, read Mr. Gerald Fleury's feature article in the July 2021 Trumpet magazine titled, "What Will Happen After Trump Regains Power?" For more detail on the latest developments regarding the ongoing election fight in America, you can read Andrew Miller's article titled, "Fight Over Mail-in Ballots Begins."
So what do you think is the probability of this For the People Act becoming, going from a proposal to a reality? And what kind of things are states doing to put those types of laws into reality already?
Yeah, I think it's pretty unlikely that the federal bill will get pushed through. Democrats are having a difficult enough time already trying to get legislation through. And the For the People Act is so radical. And it really just runs contrary to the way so many people view the way Americans' election systems should be run. That said, a lot of states have already implemented some of the key aspects of that on their own. For example, California, Washington, Oregon, those states are already too far gone. So what this For the People Act is an attempt to make those sorts of rules mandatory for all states. So it's pretty radical. It seems highly unlikely that it would pass, but they're going to try to push this with the same fervor that they've been trying to push Build Back Better.
Great. Well, it would certainly make this fight very interesting to watch. And we'll put a link to both of those articles, and especially that one from Mr. Fleury, "What Will Happen After Donald Trump Regains Power," so that you can really understand what is going to be happening with that upcoming fight. Well, it's not just the United States that has a potential political comeback. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, or ex-German Chancellor Angela Merkel's main rival, a man she defeated on her way to the top, is on his way back too. He's in charge of Miss Merkel's party. Here to tell us all about it is Mihailo Zekic.
Yeah, so obviously one of the big stories we've been covering for quite a while now is the German elections that happened in September and the aftermath of them. As longtime listeners of the show would know, Olaf Scholz of the Social Democratic Party was able to beat the Christian Democratic Party, or CDU, of Angela Merkel's party. And so because of that, the CDU has had a leadership crisis. The former contender for the chancellorship, Armin Laschet, he resigned. And the winner of the newest leadership elections for the CDU is Friedrich Merz. We cover a lot of German politicians on this show and on thetrumpet.com. Friedrich Merz might be one of these politicians that our listeners might not be as familiar about, just because we might not have covered as much about him. That doesn't mean he's not important. He's been around for a very, very long time. He actually used to be the leader of the CDU way back in the early 2000s, and he was beaten in a leadership election again by Angela Merkel, who went on a few years later to become chancellor. And since then, he's had a bit of a chip off of his shoulder. He's in his mid-60s now, and our writer for German Affairs, Josue Michels, he calls him Merkel's arch rival, and he's tried to make his way up to the top twice in recent history. He tried to get in during the original leadership election on who would replace Merkel as candidate of the CDU, and he was beaten by Merkel's chosen successor, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer. Then when she resigned after not doing so well, he ran again, and he was beaten again by Merkel's chosen successor, Armin Laschet. Now, Laschet's resigned, Friedrich Merz finally got the top job, and everyone's really interested in what he's going to do. He's seen as being much more to the right as Mrs. Merkel. He's accused her of bringing the CDU, the traditional German conservative party, far further and further to the left. And a main view of what he wants done with the party and with Germany is to bring things back more towards the traditional right-wing ground of that the party used to stand for.
And I guess that's something that does make him quite significant for us to watch, because that's a direction of travel that we've been anticipating Germany heading in for quite some time.
Oh, totally. And there's a lot of really interesting things about him that make it catch one's eyebrows. For example, he's not just Merkel's arch rival. You could almost consider him the current coalition's arch rival, or the current German government, Scholz and his two coalition partners. We've talked before in this program about how Olaf Scholz and the Greens and the Free Democrats that he's come into coalitions with have a massive, massive economic platform to restructure Germany's economy, to phase out coal completely by the end of the decade, to put in all this massive levels of debt spending that's unprecedented in post-war German history. And we've talked about in the Trumpet and articles and on the show on how disastrous that would be to the German economy. Friedrich Merz is the exact opposite of that. He's an old school businessman. He, since being kicked out by Merkel in the early 2000s, he's become a multimillionaire. He's very much in favor of classical economic theory. He's worked for a lot of different companies. He's used to work for the Cologne Bonn Airport. He was chairman of the supervisory board of the investment group BlackRock's German branch. And so he might be considered as a possible contender if and when things go south for the current German government, as somebody who can save the day, somebody who can inject a new economic life into Germany, a country that's traditionally known as having a robust economy. But he's also seen as politically incorrect than even Angela Merkel and many other figures in the CDU. He's reportedly associated homosexuality with pedophilia and called transgender issues unimportant, which in politically correct Europe is not exactly a nice thing to say. He's called for a stricter assimilation of refugees. He's Catholic. He actually comes from the same Bundesland or state as Armin Laschet, North Rhine-Westphalia, which is Germany's most populous state and one of the Catholic heartlands of the country. And so he has a lot of aspects about his legacy and his beliefs that make him an interesting figure to watch.
And another man we're watching, I don't know, you might have the quote in front of you. I don't, but I seem to remember Karl Theodor zu Gutenberg. He kind of endorsed Merz as well, didn't he, when he was running in the past?
He did, actually. In the run-up to the election of Armin Laschet won, which Friedrich Merz was competing with, Karl Theodor zu Gutenberg, who was also considered a potential front-runner to enter to become the leader of the CDU-CSU coalition, said on January 17th of last year, "For me, there is only one politician in the Christian Democratic Union left who I consider perfectly suitable for this task and who I would vote for, Friedrich Merz." Now, longtime listeners of the show would know of the Trumpet's focus on watching a strong German leader to appear on the scene and to take control of Europe and bring new life to it. Mr. Gutenberg's been a man we've been following very intently for that reason. And there are a lot of actually similarities between Gutenberg and Merz. Both come from Catholic backgrounds. Both are very, very popular with the base, or in Gutenberg's case, at least used to be very popular with the conservative base, but may not necessarily be seen as somebody that the leadership have in mind for a future leader of the CDU. The normal average conservative voter actually has supported Merz for a long time. It's just the upper echelons of the CDU leadership that have had something against it, probably because of his diehard stance against Merkel and everything she stood for. And the reason they were able to chew him out before was, and originally when choosing the CDU's leaders, the party itself, the party officials chose the leader, but this time it was the party voter base in general. And Merz was able to ride the tide on this popular support. And while we expect Gutenberg to come back one way or another, how Merz might fit into this, his Catholic background, his experience, he's also an interesting man to watch.
Yeah, lots of interesting things to unpack here. That divide between the elites and kind of the ordinary German voters, I think is a very interesting trend to keep an eye on. But I mean, you've alluded to this a little already, but can you put this story kind of in context with that prophetic panorama for us?
Of course. In Revelation chapter 17, we have one of the most important prophecies of the Bible. It's of a beast, a scarlet-covered beast, which, if you tie it into other biblical passages like Revelation 13, shows to be a revived Roman Empire. It has 7 heads and 10 horns, which symbolize different resurrections of that Roman Empire. There being 7 of those resurrections. 6 of them have come and gone, the last one being Adolf Hitler's Third Reich, which means there's one more to come on the scene. And we've pointed since the beginning on Germany being the main European country that's a part of this union. You can look at other prophecies like Isaiah 10, which talk about that. But specifically, what I think is interesting is that this revived European Roman Empire will be formed out of 10 kings. You can read that in Revelation 17, verse 12. 10 different countries coming together and forming a super union. And it's interesting speculation on how exactly this will all play out. We've talked about Germany being the head of this union, but we have speculated in the past that while there may be one super king over the 10 kings, that doesn't necessarily mean that he governs Germany directly. In other words, there could be a super emperor over the 10 kings and another one of these 10 kings or dictators ruling over Germany specifically. And however Karl Theodor zu Gutenberg plays into this remains to be seen, but it wouldn't be too surprising if he ended up getting the top job as the president of this new revived European power. He used to be former German defense minister. His replacement as defense minister, Ursula von der Leyen, she's the EU executive commissioner currently, so he could perhaps follow the same route. But while he's in Brussels or wherever the European capital will be, there might be another dictator that's over Germany individually that follows similar policies that gives his support to the main government. And Merz could very well be the man for the job.
Awesome. Some solid prophecy and some interesting speculation there as well. Where would you point us to learn more on this subject?
Well, we have our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has written a booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. That's a good one-stop shop to focus on why we look at Germany and why it's rising, why we look at a man like Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg specifically. But if you would like to know more about Friedrich Merz, again, our writer, José Michels, has written two articles on him. One of them's fairly recent. Germany's Friedrich Merz is again on the rise. And another one from a while back when it looked like Merz might have made a political comeback earlier is Friedrich Merz, Germany's Future. Both are really, really informative articles of a man we haven't really covered as much in detail as some other German politicians, but he's certainly a man to watch regardless. And those two articles can help you fill you in with why we think he's important.
Great. Another thing that's making a comeback is the Iran deal. And just like last time that the Iran nuclear deal was being pushed, people are out there trying to demonize Saudi Arabia to make Iran look good by comparison. Here to tell us more is Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this is a really interesting story that CNN released just this week on December 23rd. And it's an exclusive report to show that the United States has intelligence that shows that Saudi Arabia is now building its own ballistic missiles with the help of China. I'll just quote from this report from CNN. It says this: Saudi Arabia is known to have purchased ballistic missiles from China in the past, but has never been able to build its own until now, according to three sources familiar with the latest intelligence. And then it says U.S. officials at numerous agencies, including the National Security Council at the White House, have been briefed in recent months on classified intelligence revealing multiple large-scale transfers of sensitive ballistic missile technology between Saudi Arabia and China, according to two sources. So it is an important story to cover, and I think the reason we would find this very interesting is the fact that it comes amidst the negotiations, which are meant to renew next week with Iran and the nuclear program. And of course, one of the biggest things with Iran has been not just their push towards nuclear breakout, which they are only a couple of weeks away now from that, but it's the delivery system, Iran's work on the delivery system of a nuclear weapon, being able to use a ballistic missile with a nuclear warhead and to deliver their upcoming nuclear bomb. And so the United States and the UN Security Council and allies in the region have tried for a long time to stop Iran's ballistic missile program. They're designing their weapon, their ability to fire these future nuclear weapons. And Iran has pushed back on this very hard and basically have said, even with the previous nuclear deal, the one in 2015 that the Obama administration negotiated, this was the big sticking point for Iran. Basically, no, we're not going to give up our ballistic missile program. They changed the wording, and this was the last minute part of the nuclear deal that was holding it up, was Iran said, no, you cannot say in this deal that we are going to stop our ballistic missile program. You can water down the wording and say the deal calls on Iran or calls for Iran to stop its ballistic missile program, but you cannot tell us to stop. And they didn't. But now what we have is that the United States' former chief ally in the region, at least in the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, they're building their own ballistic missiles. So the point of this, as far as the United States government leaking this story to CNN, is to show that Iran isn't the only power in the region that has ballistic missiles and a ballistic missile program. Look, Saudi Arabia has it as well. And so who are we to call on Iran to stop with their ballistic missile program if even Saudi Arabia is doing it?
And what's the agenda there? Well, I mean, I guess you spoke of a lot of the agenda, but why is this administration so intent on coming up with a deal with Iran?
Well, I think, I mean, the biggest point behind this is that, and we've commented on this for a long time, is that the United States policy of Barack Obama in the region is to empower Iran at the expense of traditional allies. And Mr. Gerald Fleury has written about this for going on a decade now. But the problem with this policy is that it's deeply unpopular with the United States public. the United States public cannot be fooled on this, or at least they're attempting to fool them. But they know Iran is bad. They know Iran's chance, death to America, death to Israel. And so why are we going to give them a pass? And so the whole point of this specific leak then is to be sold for domestic consumption. When the United States comes out and says, hey, we can't curtail Iran's ballistic missile program because Saudi Arabia, our ally, is doing it too, then it kind of gives them a pass with the American public. And so I think that's what they tried to do with the first nuclear deal, and that's what they're going to try to do with the second, is try and pull the wool over the American public's eyes, all the while empowering Iran and giving them a free pass to develop ballistic missiles.
Great. Thank you very much for that, Brent. Coming up, Germany's relationship with China is very interesting to watch at the moment. China is reaching out for other allies around the world. France is drawing close to countries across the Middle East. And finally, we say a not so fond farewell to a key player in America's response to COVID. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Russia is not the only one drawing closer to China. Germany has a new government, and many called unexpected even this new government to break with Angela Merkel's policies on China and instead to distance themselves from China. But we're getting indications that they are going to do the opposite. Here to tell us more, we'll go back to Mihailo.
Yeah, so as mentioned, Angela Merkel is on the way out. She was known for being, well, I wouldn't say exactly a cheerleader of China's, but she has walked a fine tightrope between condemning Chinese human rights abuses while at the same time pursuing strong trade relations with China. When she was in charge of the rotating presidency of the EU Council, she tried hard to get a large EU-China investment deal pushed through. It didn't make it before she was voted out. And the new government under Olaf Scholz, he got into coalition agreements, as we talked about, with the Green Party. And the Green Party, one of the Green Party's leaders, Annalena Baerbock, she is a staunch, you could say, opponent of China. She talks about having a values-based foreign policy. She's been speaking out critically about China's policies with the Uyghurs and Xinjiang. And a lot of people are speculating with somebody like Annalena Baerbock, who's now the German foreign minister, in charge, that Berlin might sing a different tune. That's not the case. Olaf Scholz had his first phone call with Chinese President Xi Jinping on December 21st. There's two readings of the phone call. One was published by the state-owned Chinese medium Xinhua, while another one was obtained by Politico EU. And according to the transcript or the selections from Xinhua, it talks about Scholz talking about Germany is willing to work with China in the spirit of mutual respect and mutual trust to push for further development of the Germany-China all-round strategic partnership. And there's other little quotes similar to that from Scholz and Xi that make it sound like the new government wants to pursue really strong relations with China. According to comparing both of the readings, Politico noted that no mention apparently was made of China's crackdown in Hong Kong or any other Chinese rights abuses, what's happening in Xinjiang, the threat of invading Taiwan. And so a lot of people are looking at this and thinking maybe Mr. Scholz has betrayed what many were expecting of him, and even some aspects that were put into the coalition agreement with the Free Democrats and the Greens. The coalition agreement said specifically that the new German government would clearly address China's human rights violations, especially in Xinjiang. And this obviously didn't happen. Again, it's one phone call. It's too early to tell what exactly will come from this. But another detail that's come out is Scholz says that he wants to push the EU investment package that Merkel didn't get through as quickly as possible, which again betrays another aspect of the coalition agreement. So we'll see exactly how this happens, but it looks like Chinese and German relations will be as rosy as ever.
And this is something that that Trump Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flory very specifically forecast, I think back in 2010, 2011, this German-Chinese relationship. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. He wrote a book called Isaiah's End Time Vision. Chapter 7 specifically talks about the growing relationship between the EU and China. It delves into a prophecy in Isaiah 23, which talks about a mart of nations or a trade bloc. And it talks about Tyre being involved in it, not the ancient city, though, but that's a code name for the modern European Union, which in other biblical prophecies, as we've talked about on this show, will eventually economically and later militarily besiege America, Britain, the state of Israel. And it talks about it being allied with Khitan, which is an ancient name for China and other Asian powers. And so before it attacks America economically, or even as it's attacking America economically, the EU will be fostering a trade relationship with these great Asian economies like China, Japan, countries like that. And if you put these two together, the EU is technically the world's largest economy. China is the world's largest national economy. You put those two together, sprinkle a few other major economies in there, and America and Britain, Israel can be shut out of world trade, which would be devastating. And we're seeing the first seeds of these of this relationship being sown with events like the Scholz Xi phone call.
Thank you very much for that, Mihailo Zekic. France is also working on developing its own allies, especially within the Middle East. Here to tell us about this story, it's back to Brent.
Yeah, this is a really interesting story that relates a lot to what we were talking about in the first half of the program, how the United States, in seeking to empower Iran at the expense of its traditional allies, such as the Gulf states and Israel, you have the Gulf states and Israel seeking other allies. They have to look elsewhere. And there was a story this week in CNN. It's entitled "France's $19 billion Weapons Deal is Sweet Revenge," and it basically goes and talks about what had happened under President Trump. You'll remember this deal that President Trump had to sell. I think the CNN report has it in here, but the United States had a $23 billion deal drawn up with President Trump and the UAE, the United Arab Emirates. And this was for the sale of F-35 fighter jets and some other weaponry. And Biden gets into power and he says, we're not going to do that. We're going to put this deal on ice for a while. We're not going to sell any arms to the UAE. And so it's kind of been on and off again. And this deal hasn't gone forward yet. And then you had earlier this month, you had Macron of France, the leader, flying down to the UAE. And as he gets there, he announces, or he discusses his own counter deal with the UAE. This time it's a $19 billion order for 80 Rafale fighter jets and 12 military helicopters. And so at the time, this is 3 weeks ago now, the UAE has two offers on the table. You have the United States offer that was withdrawn, that the Biden administration says they might be willing to consider. And you have the French deal that says, hey, here's 80 fighter jets. It's going to be a little cheaper than the American deal. Now, the UAE has decided that they are done with the United States deal. No, we are not going to purchase your fighter jets. We are going to go with the French. And I think one of the main reasons, as this article brings out, that the UAE did this is because the United States now is not a trustworthy ally in the region, and because they were going to limit the use of the fighter jets when they sold them to the UAE. They wouldn't have the freedom to use them as they deemed fit. And so if basically what I think happened is the Biden administration made it such a difficult deal for the UAE to pay all this money to get some fighter jets, but they would be limited in their use. And the French come along and say, hey, here's a counter deal, similar weaponry, cheaper. Do you want it? And the UAE says, yep, we're done with the United States. We're going to go with France.
So what's behind France pursuing this kind of relationship? I guess in the first half, you talked about America moving away from their relationship with Saudi Arabia, or at least this administration. Why is France trying to move towards them?
Well, I think it's probably two points. I think that the French are probably upset with the United States over the AUKUS treaty with Australia and the fact that Australia is not going to buy French submarines and things like that. So it's probably hitting back about that. But it's also just the real danger that allies, the Gulf states in the region, also Europe, they're starting to fear Iran a whole lot more because Europe, France understand that the Iranians are a jihadi or a jihadi nation that's on the cusp of getting nuclear weapons, and they see the United States is not willing to do it anymore. They're not willing to counter Iran. They're not really willing to hold up the Gulf states and support the Gulf states as the traditional counter to Iranian hegemony in the Middle East. And so France is coming in there and saying, we'll do it. We'll do it. It's necessary that Europe stands up to Iran because we are a lot closer to the Iranians than the Americans are. We're probably going to be on the receiving end of some of the Iranian action. And so we are going to support the Gulf.
And this shift is one that we watched closely because it's directly prophesied, right?
Yeah, extremely. We watch it so closely because it's something that's very clear in biblical prophecy that the Gulf states are going to pursue an alliance with European nations led by Germany. And we've written about this at length. We have a Trends article that I think people can read. It's entitled Why the Trumpet Watches an Alliance Between Arab Nations and Europe. And it goes into this prophecy found in Psalm 83 that talks about, gives the ancient names for basically the Arabian Peninsula and some other modern Arab states that are going to side with Germany. And we have talked about, at least in the past 8 years, how this alliance comes about because of Iran's growing dominance and the fact that the United States is leaving the region and empowering Iran. We wrote an article in the print, I think the Trumpet print, going back 8 months now. And we said this: until President Obama, America sought to contain Iran's conquest in the region. With America switching sides, former U.S. allies aren't left with many options. Try to placate the Americans and hope to survive the next 4 years, or band together and reach out for help elsewhere. And that's exactly what they're doing. They've got internal defense pacts amongst the Gulf and even including Israel now. But now they're looking out for European intervention as well. The conclusion of this article says, watch for the United States to continue to empower Iran, watch for deserted U.S. allies to form a partnership, and look for help from Europe, and watch Europe to become more resolute against Iran's provocative moves. We are seeing this happen clearly with this deal between France and the UAE.
Thank you very much for that, Brent. Now, China is also reaching around the world, creating a system of allies, even overseas military bases. And here to tell us about one of the latest relationships that they're working on, we'll hear again from Andrew.
Yeah, over the past week, Nicaragua has received over 1 million COVID vaccines from China. But Nicaragua definitely paid for these vaccines, and in more than just money. Earlier this month, Nicaragua actually severed all political ties and diplomatic recognition of Taiwan, and instead established diplomatic relations with communist China. Now, this decision is a major blow to Taiwan, which only about 70 years ago was the only China in the world, and now actually only has 13 nations and the Vatican that recognize it as an independent nation. Most of the rest of the world, I think it's up to about 178 United Nations members now, if you include the recent addition of Nicaragua, say that communist China is the real China and do not recognize Taiwan. Now, the Communist Party of China, they do regard Taiwan as a breakaway province and have been using many tools in their disposal to pressure nations into refusing to recognize it. Actually, vaccine sales being just one of the most recent, being particularly effective in Latin America, where they're making military deals and economic deals and vaccine sales to nations that will break ties with Taiwan. And Nicaragua is just the most recent to finally break those ties with Taiwan and switch its allegiance over to communist China, which is really significant, not just for Taiwan, but also for the United States. It was actually back during President Donald Trump's second year in office, back in 2018, that U.S. National Security Advisor at the time, John Bolton, warned that Nicaragua had already turned against the United States, saying that in Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, we see the perils of poisonous ideologies left unchecked and the dangers of domination and suppression. this troika of tyranny, this triangle of terror stretching from Havana to Caracas to Managua, is the cause of immense human suffering. So he's talking about Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba being a trioka of tyranny and a triangle of terror, pointing out that these are really three Marxist-Leninist regimes that form a triangle around the Caribbean Sea, with Venezuela there at the bottom, Cuba kind of in the middle of it, actually, and then Nicaragua over there at the west end. And so if a nation like China or Russia can really form strong alliances with these nations, even military alliances, then that really gives them the ability to put bases and weapons along the trade routes that America desperately needs. It's actually half of all our seaborne trade comes in through the Gulf of Mexico, which has to pass within 90 miles of the island of Cuba. Cuba already being a strong Chinese ally, but you add Venezuela and Nicaragua to that as well. And China's getting quite a bit of power there in the Caribbean Sea that it could use to the United States' detriment, especially now that there's tensions between the United States and China over Taiwan and between the United States over Russia in Crimea. The Caribbean is a main way that these two powers that Vladimir Putin said have an alliance unlike any other in history just yesterday could strike back at the United States.
Now, this ties in quite strongly with the story that Mihailo was talking about earlier, doesn't it?
Right. I actually had planned to talk a bit about the Mart of Nations for this segment. I think Mihailo covered that really well, so I'll just bring up one other scripture in Deuteronomy 20:18 that talks about America being besieged in all its gates. And that's something that the Mart of Nations really uses against the United States when it does this besiege, is its sea gates. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has a new book out about the Panama Canal. And how really that the Panama Canal, it's referred to in the Bible not just as a sea gate, but the sea gate, the most important one to the United States. And so that prophecy in Deuteronomy 28, it talks about this Mart of Nations led by China and the European Union coming against the United States. The Panama Canal is going to be one of the primary, if not the primary, weapon they use to conduct that trade siege. And they don't have really deep ties between Panama and China, other than they do own the company that runs the toll booths on either end of the canal. But these ties developing between China, Nicaragua, Cuba, and Venezuela could be really important in giving China the military presence in the Caribbean Sea to be able to control that canal and choke off so much of the trade that America relies on to keep its standard of living and defense capabilities where they need to be.
Thank you for that, Andrew. Well, as we come to the end of the show, we're going to talk about a man who's coming to the end of his career. Dr. Francis Collins is stepping down. To tell us more about this man and how he's changed America, we'll go back to Sam.
Next week will be Dr. Francis Collins's last as leader of the United States National Institutes of Health. Dr. Collins is better known as Anthony Fauci's boss. After 12 years, Collins announced his retirement in October. Collins and Fauci have become the public faces of the government's fight against COVID. When Dr. Collins announced his upcoming retirement, he said, "I fundamentally believe that no single person should serve in the position too long." And that was sort of an odd statement, considering he served in that position longer than anyone else in history. Collins is 71. He's 9 years younger than Anthony Fauci, so you could consider this an early departure. And perhaps, as many are speculating, he's trying to get out before a lot of these investigations heat up, especially looking into his culpability for the COVID-19 pandemic and his institution's funding of the Wuhan Virology Lab. Perhaps Collins is just trying to get out before the real firestorm hits. Collins continues to deny the commonly accepted theory that COVID-19 came from Wuhan, that Wuhan lab, And on his last day in office, December 19th, he told Fox News that, "I'm really sorry that the lab leak has become such a distraction for so many people, because frankly, we still don't know. There is no evidence really to say." And again, it was sort of an odd interview. Rather than focusing on the highlights of his career, and he had some extraordinary accomplishments as the director of the NIH, he focused primarily on trying to convince the roughly 72% of Americans who believe COVID-19 leaked out of the lab that they were mistaken. Dr. Collins has also denied that accusations surrounding his agency's involvement in gain-of-function research at the Wuhan lab had anything to do with his resignation. The NIH has funneled nearly $1 million to that lab in Wuhan. Leaked emails between Fauci and Collins also show that they worked to silence dissenting voices from top scientists who suggested that COVID-19 originated in the lab and who were skeptical of lockdowns. In that interview, Collins said, "We in this country have somehow gotten all fractured into a hyper-polarized, politicized view that never should have been mixed with public health." He says, "It has been ruinous, and history will judge harshly those people who have continued to defocus the effort and focus on conspiracies and things that are demonstrably false." Despite his assertion that science and politics should not be mixed, Collins and Fauci have really been responsible for injecting those things into public health. Dr. Collins has a history of working with the Chinese Communist Party. He's worked for some groups that are linked to a Chinese general, a major general of the Chinese People's Liberation Army. He has a history of close contact with Chinese military figures. And if anyone should have known how money was being used, how U.S. taxpayer money was being used by the Chinese people in Wuhan, it should have been him. The NIH has already fired 50 researchers for failing to disclose their links to the Chinese Communist Party. So it could be, again, that Dr. Collins is just trying to resign before he comes under fire. The COVID crisis has exposed the Communist Party's working like nothing else. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote that the coronavirus has exposed the true nature of the Chinese Communist Party as nothing ever has. He says, "For years, China has worked ferociously to surpass the U.S. in economic power and scientific advancements." And you could say that Dr. Collins puts a face on that partnership, America helping the Chinese Communist Party. Joe Biden would not be in the White House today if it were not for the lengths Dr. Collins and Dr. Fauci and others went to cover up the virus's true origins until it was too late. So there's a lot of corruption going on at the head offices of these big American institutions. The prophet Isaiah described end-time America as a sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors. And he goes on to talk about the decrepit state of American leadership. Now, Dr. Collins can claim that the lab leak theory is a conspiracy theory, but that does not change the fact that he sent millions of dollars to institutions run by the Chinese Communist Party for genetics research, and it does not change the fact that America's government is rotten from head to foot. To learn more about this topic, you can look forward to reading Andrew Miller's upcoming article, A Farewell for Dr. Francis Collins.
Thank you for that, Sam. In a lot of ways, it ties in to even what Brent was talking about earlier in the show about Iran, where you've got a United States administration working against American interests, whether it comes to working with China, working with infectious diseases, working with Iran's nuclear program. Well, that is about all we have time for on the show. I'd like to say thank you to all of our panelists, Andrew Miller, Sam Livingston, Brent Noctegal, and Mihailo Zekic. Thank you to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. And I'll leave you today with a quote from Ludwig van Beethoven. "Anyone who tells a lie has not a pure heart and cannot make a good soup." Well, like I said, that's about all we have time for. Join us next time on Trumpet Hour.
listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.